Thanks for tuning in to the Thirst for More podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Smitley. Thirst for More podcast was created to help strength and conditioning coaches, personal trainers, fitness enthusiasts, and anyone that loves lifting heavy shit all be connected under one roof. We take deep dives into coaching, programming and training, running gyms, nutrition, and overall improving your knowledge in the field of strength and conditioning. If you're new here, I'm glad you're able to tune in and hope you can just take away one awesome piece of information today to help you along with your journey. If you're a returning supporter, I appreciate you being along for the ride. Now let's dive into today's episode. So you can walk into 10 different gyms in America today and talk to 10 completely different trainers, and most are going to tell you 10 different rules about training that completely contradict each other. And most of them, and the ones that sound the most confident, are usually flat out wrong. There's not being nuanced, not it depends. They are just flat out wrong. And the research has been very clear on the things I'm going to talk about today for well over a decade, but the fitness industry keeps recycling the same myths because they're easy to sell, they're easy to post about, and they're easy to sound smart repeating out at a family function, barbecue, out in public, surrounded by friends. So today, I'm going to kill 8 of these myths. I'm not going to bend around them. I'm not going to soften things. I'm actually going to give you everything you need to know that these are not true. And if any of these have been part of your programming or worse, part of what you've been teaching clients as a coach, then I want you to sit with this for a second and really absorb the information I'm giving you. And hopefully it's going to help level up your training and the information that you're passing on. Because this show at the end of the day isn't about necessarily trying to promote what people think actually works. My show is actually rooted in science and practical standpoint and being a real coach, helping other people improve their health, fitness, performance, and lifestyle. And so at the end of the day, my job is trying to help make you better here on this podcast. So with that said, welcome back to the Thirst for More podcast. I'm Brandon Smitley, your host, and this is going to be a show where we're going to stop pretending that the fitness industry has been operating in good faith and start looking at what the actual research says behind some of these things, especially when it comes to regards to training, recovery, and overall human performance. Now, if you happen to be new to the Thirst for More podcast, welcome. If you've been with me for a long period of time, you already know the general format and how I like to run my podcast. I don't really dress things up. I don't run for cover with bad ideas because they're popular. I make sure to provide the sources of things I'm talking about in the show notes and also mention them here in the actual podcast itself, because I believe the way that we move things forward is taking the practical side mixed with the evidence-based side and have a good quality standard of everything that we talk about from a fitness, performance, strength and conditioning-based perspective. Now, with that all said, today's episode I think can be one of those uncomfortable ones. Because I'm going to take aim and some shots at 8 myths that I guarantee that you've either heard, you've read, or seen probably even on Instagram in the past week or so. And this is the part that should make us uncomfortable as professionals, in my opinion, is that there's a real chance that we've taught one of these to a client at some point. I was probably guilty of some of these at some point very early on in my career. We've all done it. That's okay. But the job is obviously to stop doing it, level up the education, and also give us a ability to talk to our clients with some actual evidence-based approaches of some of these myths, because usually clients are wanting to know, well, this is what I heard from so-and-so, whatever. This is going to be able to let you put that in the rest, but also let you pass the information on as you need to help level up your clients or your own training that you need there today. So we're going to walk through each individual myth. I'm going to talk about the popular belief of it, what the research side of the things say, and then what it means for how we should be coaching and performing and using these things in real world applications. So if you want to grab something to take notes with, I think that's not a bad thing. Otherwise, sit back, relax, enjoy the show. You might even get some good laughs. Because at the end of the episode, you're going to have some programming decisions that you can make, adjust, or how you're going to talk to your clients to break some of these myths. So let's dive into it now that they got the introduction all wrapped up. Now, myth number one is going to be that you have to train every set to failure to build muscle. And this is one that drives me up a wall every time I happen to hear it. The idea that every working set needs to go to absolute technical failure or you're leaving gains on the table. And you've heard the lines of, you know, if you've got one more rep in the tank, you didn't train hard enough, or maybe hear something like failure is the only thing that actually builds muscle. You might hear coaches saying, one more, go get it, right? You know, motivating you to keep going to get another rep and to where the bar or the weight is barely moving and form has gone completely out the window. And so here's what the research says about training to failure. Now, Brad Schoenfeld and Jozo Goric, I hope I said his name correctly, published a 2019 review in Strength and Conditioning Journal that looked exactly at this question that we're talking about today is, does training to failure produce more hypertrophy than stopping just short of failure? And the conclusion here is that training to failure is not required for muscle growth, and in many cases, it produces equivalent results to stopping 1 to 3 reps shy of failure. Now, in 2016, Nobrega and colleagues published in the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research took this even a step further, that they directly compared training to failure versus training to a self-selected stopping point, and they found similar gains in muscle and size and strength between the two groups in trained men. And just in the last year or so, and definitely more recently, Raffalo and colleagues published a systematic review showing that stopping 0 to 5 reps shy of failure produces nearly identical hypertrophy outcomes to actual failure training with significantly less overall fatigue. So knowing that there's less fatigue, that is the key aspect to take away here. Now, because here's what failure and training to failure does that many people don't talk about is it crushes your recovery and it tanks your central nervous system. It compromises your second working set or maybe your second exercise, your second session of the week. And in the long run, it limits the total volume that you can perform and volume. So the total amount of hard sets that you can actually get in for your training is the actual primary driver of hypertrophy. Now, Schoenfeld's 2017 meta-analysis in the Journal of Sports Sciences establishes this very clearly. So when you push every set to absolute failure, you're not necessarily always maximizing muscle growth. You're trading volume for intensity, and the math doesn't work in your favor over the course of a training block. Now, I'm not saying that you can't train hard and have sessions that you can get after it. Everybody's gonna have days that things feel great and you wanna push it, and I 100% condone that. I think there's nothing wrong with that. However, when you look at training as a whole, more cases than not, if we look at a standard bell curve, your training is normally gonna end up somewhere in the middle of that bell curve, right? You're gonna have just so-so training sessions. It's not gonna be the greatest, it's not gonna be the worst, it's just gonna be an average training session. And those are the sessions that you really wanna kind of understand this training to failure aspect that's probably not worth the squeeze, right? The juice isn't worth the squeeze at this point. But if we go to the far right of that bell curve, where we're having one of those 1 out of 10 or 1 out of 20 training sessions where everything feels light, things feel good, mood's great, recovery's great, everything just feels 1,000%, then push it, right? But on the opposite end of the spectrum, we also have those sessions, 1 to 2 out of 10 or 20 sessions that things feel like absolute crap. They feel in the dumps, nothing feels good, you can't get any rhythm, squats don't feel good, bench press feels out of groove, weights just feel heavy from the minute you walk in. That happens too. So we have to understand there's those swings and those ebbs and flows. So I don't want to deter people from training hard. I'm not saying you don't train hard, just understanding that you don't have to always train to absolute failure with every single exercise, every single session to make progress. You can leave reps in the tank. There's nothing wrong with that. So here's what you can do instead. Most working sets by hypertrophy should ideally stop about 1 to 3 reps in reserve. So save your true failure for the last set of an exercise. So the last one that you got going, maybe that's the one that you push. And maybe even the last set of a movement pattern or the lower body day or the upper body day, or maybe even for some isolation work where the systematic cost is going to be lower, something like a tricep press down or a bicep curl or a lateral raise or something like that. And if you happen to be squatting heavy, say on a Tuesday, and you take your top set to grinding failure, then you're probably going to still be feeling that on Thursday. And so that bench session could end up suffering. That's going to be later in the week. And then so is the squat session potentially the following week. And this can begin to compound. Now, programming wise, what this means for us as coaches is that we have to actually teach our athletes and clients what proximity to failure actually feels like. And this is kind of a hard thing to discuss in real world application. Now, RIR or reps in reserve, it is a skill and it's not innate for most people. There's research from Helms and colleagues showing that lifters become more accurate at gauging reps in reserve as their training experience increases, but novices systematically underestimate how many reps that they actually have left in the tank, which means if you tell a new trainee or a new client to stop at 1 to 2 reps in reserve, they're probably stopping at like 3 or 4. And conversely, if you tell them to go to failure, they're probably going way past the technical aspect of failure. The fix is to actually rep things out occasionally and calibrate things out. So take a set to true failure once every 6 to 8 weeks for your major lift or movement patterns and use that as kind of like your reference point. And the rest of the time, just make sure you're always leaving gas in the tank. Now, the bigger lesson here is one that we'll come back to multiple times here within the episode and what I've got laid out, but the fitness industry loves a binary look and approach. Failure or nothing, heavy or nothing, carbs, no carbs, right? The research almost never supports the binary approach to training and or anything in the fitness industry. So I always say it depends. And the research supports the dose response curve. And the curve for proximity to failure is very clear that most of the benefit comes from getting close to failure. The marginal benefit of pushing all the way to failure is small, but the cost is also high. So we want to stop coaching every set like we're training for the Olympics or something major that's really happening in our lives. Most sets should just be productive, hard, and end with just a couple reps left in the tank. And that's where you're going to see majority of your gains over the course of your training career. And it's also going to make sure that things continue to feel good. You can build positive momentum. It can easily account for good days and bad days, right? It's much easier to pivot when you need it to do so. All right. So myth number 2 is going to be that lifting heavy makes women bulky. So I want to address this one carefully because it's a myth that's been weaponized in 2 different directions. It's been used to scare women out of the weight room and also used to dunk on women who have legitimate athletic aesthetic preferences. So we're going to focus on the physiology side because the physiology is very, very robust here. Now, the myth is that if a woman lifts heavy, you know, they pick up a barbell, they train like an athlete, that she's going to end up looking, quote unquote, bulky. But here is the reality. Testosterone is the primary anabolic driver for the kind of large scale muscle hypertrophy that people associate with that big, bulky, blocky, massive kind of look, right? Adult men typically have circulating testosterone levels between 270 and even over 1,000 nanograms per deciliter of testosterone. Now, adult women typically have between 15 and 70 nanograms per deciliter. So that's not exactly a small gap. That's roughly 15 to 20 times less testosterone on average than the average man. So that means physiologically that women, especially the natural lifters, have a dramatically lower ceiling for the kind of hypertrophy that produces that quote unquote bulky appearance that everyone seems to think about. Now, research from Roberts and colleagues published in Sports Medicine in 2020 looked at sex differences in resistance training adaptations. And the finding was that while women gain strength and hypertrophy at similar relative rates to men, the absolute magnitude of muscle gain, so the actual size, is significantly smaller because the hormonal environment is not supporting it. So when a female athlete starts squatting twice a week and her quads get more developed, that's not quote unquote bulk. That's just visible muscle that was always going to be there with proper training. And the bulky women that you happen to see in magazines, on social media, are in the overwhelming majority of cases either elite genetic outliers training at extreme volumes, or they're using performance-enhancing drugs, or very commonly, it's probably both. And the natural female lifter who trains hard 4 to 5 days per week does not, cannot look like that. Okay, the physiology will not allow it. And this is another hard conversation, is that there's too many women in the fitness industries that are using some kind of performance-enhancing drugs. And listen, I don't care whether you use them or not. It does not matter to me. I've been very clear on this for years, that you do whatever you want to do. However, whenever you're using some kind of performance-enhancing drug and you're using it to sell a product or a result and you're not open about that said product or result, that you're using, that's where I begin to have beef with things, because you're not being honest with your audience. And I know that using performance enhancing drugs is illegal. You should not be doing that without, like, obviously prescription or doctor or medical reasons. I'm not going to go into that as well either, but that's where I usually have some issues with the performance enhancing drug size when it comes to selling and marketing and being able to tout the response of training programs or people that you're working with. Like, if you're not being honest about the supplemental side of things, that to me doesn't sit well. People are going to do their own thing, but I just want to clear that out of the way, that that's also another issue that you see in the fitness industry that stems back to this women being bulky and whatever, right? Because the genetic elite and the ones using the performance enhancing drugs are going to be the ones that get the most views, the most traction, the most marketing that you're going to see on social media. And so that's where women tend to get their thought process, that they're going to look like that. Now, the other piece of this conversation is body composition. And so when a female client or athlete or person starts lifting, she'll often build a little bit of muscle while also losing some fat in the process, particularly if her nutrition is in line and dialed up. So the net effect is usually she gets smaller in the absolute terms, more athletic in shape, while feeling stronger and more capable. Now, Briner and colleagues showed back in 1999 that resistance training during caloric restriction preserved lean mass and improved resting metabolic rate better than dieting alone in women. And that research has been replicated dozens of times since that study done back in 1999. So for coaches and trainers, if we have female clients who walk in afraid of getting bulky or building too much muscle, here's the conversation that we need to have, is that one, the hormonal environment of the average natural female lifter makes the bulky outcome essentially impossible without years of focused effort and probably some kind of pharmacology involved. Number two is that the physical changes that you'll see from strength training are improved muscle definition, improved posture, better body composition, and smaller waist to hip silhouette if that happens to be the goal. And then number three, that the strength itself has carryover into every other part of the female's life. So from bone density perspective to fall prevention to injury resilience and even metabolic health. Now, this is true for older female clients and women as well. So the Cosman and colleagues guidelines from the National Osteoporosis Foundation specifically recommend resistance training for women in midlife and beyond to maintain bone mineral density and reduce fracture risk. So there's a 2017 meta-analysis from Watson and colleagues that found high-intensity resistance training was the single most effective intervention for improving bone mineral density in postmenopausal women. The more effective, they found this to be more effective than walking, more effective than low impact cardiovascular work, and more effective than doing yoga. So the quote unquote bulky myth isn't just wrong. I would actually say that it's harmful at the end of the day for majority of women. And it's keeping a population of women out of the weight room who would benefit enormously from just being involved in a quality weight room environment, strength conditioning, or personal training based program if they happen to be new, or if they happen to progress, getting around things and just spending more time in the weight room for their overall health. And as coaches and trainers, every time that we let that myth pass unchallenged, that ends up being a problem that we happen to be feeding into. Now, one more practical note here for coaches and trainers is that the way that you market here is going to matter significantly. That if your social media is wall-to-wall photos of women in competition condition at powerlifting meets, bodybuilding shows, strongman, right, you're inadvertently reinforcing the myth for some prospective clients. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't post that content if we happen to work with those populations and they happen to do amazing things. I think it belongs. I think it's awesome to watch women crush barriers and do amazing feats of strength. Coming from the powerlifting world, those are things that I like to see. But I do believe there needs to be a balance with footage of the athletic, healthy, in-shape women lifting weights and looking the way that most of your clients actually want to look, which is just, you know, like they actually exercise, they take care of their body, they eat well, they sleep well, you know, all the normal things that we would get from quote unquote the average person, because somebody that's easier for them to relate with, right? They can't relate with the woman that's squatting 315 pounds, but they can relate to the woman that's maybe goblet squatting a 50 or 60 pound dumbbell for a hard set of 10. that is actually something that they can resonate with. And while, yes, it'd be great to get every woman to squat 300 pounds, the realistic fact is that most of them are not going to. But if we get them still doing quality movement patterns with appropriate load to meet them where they're at, that can obviously help get you an influx of more female-based clients. Now, visual evidence dismantles this myth faster than any kind of educational post that you would ever write, including this podcast. So if you happen to have women that you work with that are already doing these amazing things, grab some content or some videos of them, highlight them, and that can also maybe help you from a business perspective of getting more ladies into your gym, especially from the female side of breaking through that myth. And I will say, having been a personal trainer for as long as I have, we do a really good job of attracting female clientele. We have really broken through that barrier, and our gym, from a training perspective, from a clientele perspective, is always and has been pretty much primarily women driven. Female athletes, female personal training clients. Doesn't mean we don't get men and we don't have male athletes. We absolutely do. But that has always been relatively 60 to 70% women of our clientele. Now, I have a theory of why this is. I think, one, women are more coachable. They're more honest. They're more willing to go find people for help. Where when it comes to the weight room, guys have a hard time admitting, I don't know what to do. I don't know who to trust. I don't want to admit that I don't know what I'm doing or that I need help building muscle or losing fat. Look, there's nothing wrong with that. The hardest part is making that acceptance, but I assure you that there's nothing wrong with that. Okay. So, you know, part two of that is the guy side. But if you happen to be a very guy heavy personal trainer or coach, then I think expanding into the female side can be a great revenue boost. And in my experience, I personally enjoy working with the females. I do think they are more coachable. It's easier to get them to do stuff correctly and understand the reasons why, where the guys will usually push back a little bit more because they want to sling weight. You know, I get that. But let's move on. So moving on to myth number three is that the belief is if you're not sore, you didn't train hard enough for the day. And this one might actually be the most damaging idea in the whole commercial fitness industry, because it actually rewards bad programming and bad training. And I cannot express this enough, that the myth that delayed onset muscle soreness, or DOMS, is a reliable indicator that you had a good workout. And the deeper version of this myth says that if you're not sore after a session, you didn't train hard enough and you're not going to grow and make progress. And here's what's actually going on from a soreness perspective and why it tells you almost nothing useful about whether your training is truly productive, right? DOMS is primarily a function of two things at the end of the day. One, mechanical damage from eccentric loading. So the lengthening portion of a contraction or the lowering of a weight, like the lowering of a bicep curl or the lowering of a squat. And then number two, also novelty. The exercise being new or the volume being suddenly higher than what the body is accustomed to being able to handle. That is it. That's really all that DOMS is at the end of the day, those two things. It's not a measure of any kind of muscle protein synthesis. It's not a measure of hypertrophic stimulus. Okay, it's not a measure of how hard you actually train. Felipe Damas and colleagues published a really important study back in 2016 in the Journal of Physiology that tracked muscle damage markers and hypertrophy across a training block. And what they found was that muscle damage was high in the first few weeks of a new training program, when the trainees were sore pretty much majority of the time. And then damage markers decreased as the program continued. But hypertrophy was actually greatest in the later weeks when the soreness had largely disappeared. So in other words, the people growing the most muscle were the people who were not sore. And so let's talk about that again. The people growing the most muscle were the people who were sore because their bodies had adapted to the work that had been placed upon them. They were now able to perform more total productive volume of work because they weren't constantly recovering from the damage of the other training that they were doing. Now, Schoenfeld and Contreras put out a 2013 article in the Strength and Conditioning Journal making essentially the same point here, is that DOMS and hypertrophy are not the same construct, and using soreness as a proxy for training quality is a category error. And so why does this myth persist in our industry? Because soreness is tangible. Everybody knows what soreness feels like after you've been training. You can feel it. It's a sensation that tells you that something happened during your workout. And the gym industry has this decade reinforcing the link between feeling something and then actually getting the results. Now, CrossFit Boxes built an entire cultural identity around being so sore that you can't sit down on the toilet. Personal trainers will deliberately program movements that they know their clients aren't accustomed to just to make sure they limp out of the session and feel like they got their money's worth out of their training session. That's coaching for sensation, right? That's not coaching for actual training outcomes. And they're often very opposite things. Now, here is the fallout from all of this, is that when a client is constantly destroyed and sore for 4 to 5 days at a time, there's three things that happen. Number one is that their next session is compromised because they can't move through full ranges of motion, or at least well. Number two, their motor patterns degrade because they're moving in pain because they're sore. And then number three, they're more likely to skip training sessions, which kills the consistency that actually drives the long-term adaptation at the end of the day when it comes to strength training. Now, this doesn't mean that soreness is necessarily always a bad thing. Some soreness is absolutely normal, especially in the first couple of weeks of a new training program after a deload or after you introduce a new movement pattern. All right, that's adaptation happening. But chronic week after week, can't move the next day kind of soreness is not a sign of good quality programming. It's a sign of poorly managed volume and load progression. I've been training for 20 years now, and I still get sore. Okay. Doesn't mean that my training session was any better than anybody else's. Just means that when I mix up movement patterns and I try new things and play with new things, there's always an introductory period of getting used to that exercise. And typically when I program stuff in a new training block, I usually mark down the RPE, mark down the volume, right? You'll notice that when proper programming is laid out, new waves pull back. And they do that intentionally because you're the new stimulus that you're getting is the change of everything that's going on. Your body's like, whoa, we've been, you know, let's say Bulgarian split squatting for the past 6 to 8 weeks. And now you're going to throw in, let's just say, a lateral lunge, right? Different plane of motion, not quite amount of depth, but just the different movement pattern. Adductors are getting nice and long in that stretched out position. But there's a lot of different things happening just between those two exercises, even though they're both lower body exercises. Now, it's not that one exercise is inherently better than the other. It's just that you change the movement pattern. So there needs to be time to adjust to that. And that's with every movement pattern that you happen to program. So just keep that in mind that everybody gets sore to some extent. It's not that you should not get sore. It's just that the consistency of soreness being there is not what is showing up as a good training program. So how do you actually know if your workout was effective? And to me, these are the better metrics that you should explain to your clients or to your own training. Is one, are your numbers going up over time, right? Strength gains over weeks and months are a far better signal than soreness after the past 24 to 48 hours of your training session. Number two is that, is your body composition trending in the right direction if you're matching it with the proper nutritional protocols? And then number three, are you recovering well between your training sessions? So from workout to workout, do you feel good? Is your energy still good? Are you still able to put in good effort? Are you dragging ass, right? Those are all legitimate questions to let you know how much better your training is being laid out. Then number four, are you sleeping, eating, performing in your sport, or performing in your life much better than you were? And number five, is your athlete or client adherent? And, you know, are they still showing up week after week, still training hard? Those are outcome metrics, and soreness is a sensation metric, and those are two completely different things. Now, for coaches and trainers, something that you can do this week here is that look at the programs that you've written for your clients, say in the past month or past couple of weeks. You know, are you using high eccentric work or novel exercises as the foundation of your weekly load? So from chronic soreness baked into the schedule, or are you progressing your volume and intensity intelligently, building tolerance to a stable movement vocabulary and saving the novelty for strategic moments, right? If it's the former, then you have some rewriting to do and some things to think about when it comes to writing your training program, and that's okay. It happens to everybody. Programming evolves over time. I know I look back even several years ago, doesn't even seem like that long ago, and I think, what was I thinking? I could have did this, and better. That's a sign of growth and progress. That's a good thing at the end of the day. We've all been there. But the goal is to coach and instruct and help your clients within the things that we know about training research programming and not going against that. So it's entirely okay, but you know, you can adjust things. I do think there's periods of having hard eccentric work, right? Especially if you need to build a lot of muscle, you need to build some tolerance, but you got to introduce people to that slowly and appropriately. You can't just do all eccentric based work right off the get-go because people are going to be struggling. Okay, I think there's a nice blend there, but there are periods where I do think you can push eccentric heavy work in more particular, especially from an athletic population. I'm not going to go into that here, but obviously there are some reasons why you could do that. All right, myth number four is that you can spot reduce fat from problem areas. Now, the idea that if you do 1,000 crunches and you'll lose belly fat, or if you do lay adduction work, you know, you're going to slim your inner thighs. If you do tricep works and tricep kickbacks with 2-pound dumbbells, that you're going to reduce the back or the arm flab on the back of your arm, right? This one has been settled for a long time. It keeps coming up sometimes. I don't know why. Primarily because I think it's a fantastic marketing angle for different ab exercises or gadgets or things that you can buy, or waist trainers or Instagram booty programs. And I've already talked about this a little bit on a previous episode, so I'll try not to go too crazy, but I still want to talk about the science aspect. And as the Dispute and colleagues published a study in 2011 in the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research, where they have subjects perform 6 weeks of abdominal exercises. So 5 days a week, 7 exercises per session, 2 sets of 10 repetitions. They measured abdominal fat before and after using skin folds and circumference. And you know what they found? No significant reduction in abdominal fat compared to the control group. So they did 6 weeks of dedicated daily ab work, and there was no fat loss in the targeted area. Now, Kostick and colleagues did a similar study back in 2007 looking at unilateral resistance training of the non-dominant arm. So they had subjects train one arm for 12 weeks and then measured fat in both arms. The result was that there was no significant difference in subcutaneous fat between the trained arm and the untrained arm. So you can't pick where you're going to lose fat. Your body decides that, and the genetics that govern fat distribution are pretty stable. Some people store more in their abdomen. Some store more in their lower body. Some store relatively evenly. You can change your total body fat percentage through energy balance, but you cannot direct that fat loss to a specific area through localized exercise and training. Now, there is a small caveat that I want to address fairly here. And there's some research, including a 2017 paper from Scotto Di Palumbo and colleagues, suggesting that the area of fat surrounding an actively trained muscle may experience slightly elevated lipolysis fat breakdown during exercise. But the magnitude is very small, and that fat is still released into general circulation where it gets metabolized based on systematic energy balance. So even the strongest version of our reduction argument doesn't produce visible local fat loss. The quote-unquote active fat just gets dumped into the bloodstream and burned wherever your body burns fat from in general. So what do you do if a client happens to have a problem area? First, reset the expectations with them that the path to less belly fat is not doing more crunches. The path to less belly fat is overall fat loss through a sustainable caloric deficit paired with resistance training to preserve and build muscle and adequate protein to maintain satiety and lean tissue. That's it. The localized training matters for shaping the muscle underneath the fat, but it doesn't move the fat from that area. The second thing we need to do is train the area anyway, but for the right reason. So if a female client wants a smaller waist and stronger glutes, train her glutes hard. I'm not going to tell you not to do that. Not because the glute training is going to burn belly fat, because we know that it doesn't, but because building the glutes changes her overall proportions and the visible waist to hip ratio. Same with shoulder training for men who want to look like their waist is smaller or look more jacked, fill out their shirts. The body composition strategy is total caloric work plus strategic muscle development to reshape the silhouette or what they're going after, not local fat torching through a particular exercise. And number three here, and this is a coaching skill, is we want to manage the client psychology. So spot reduction is appealing because it gives people the sense of control. If I just do enough of hip thrusts or, you know, glute bridges or whatever, then I can fix this area, of the thing that I hate the most about my body or the area that I want to bring up. Now, taking that fantasy away is hard for many people. And it has to be replaced with something that's still motivating and keeps them going and want to show up and continue to work hard. And the replacement is usually a longer horizon body composition plan, having weekly check-ins, doing photos, measurable strength progress, writing down your weights, tracking things, right? Giving them a real plan, not just a magic exercise. And as a coach and trainers, we need to please stop selling the magic exercise if you happen to be doing this, because if your marketing is 10 minutes a day for a flat stomach, you know, in 30 days, then you're contributing to a problem that you also have to clean up whenever you happen to do consultations with other people as well. So lead with honesty. The clients who are actually going to stick around long enough to refer their friends are the ones who appreciate that you didn't lie to them and sell them a fat crap of BS about something giving them some kind of weight loss in a certain area, because it doesn't exist. So play the long game, make them understand that, hey, yes, we can train these exercises, we can build the muscle here, but at the end of the day, we can't pick where you lose fat. You can't pick where you lose fat. We've got to be in a caloric deficit, train hard, build the muscle around the areas that are important to you on top of training major movement patterns, good quality bang for your buck, getting the most out of your training time, right? That's the other thing is somebody wants a big shoulders or big butt or big juicy quads or big triceps. Like, there's nothing wrong with doing direct work for those things. But at the same time, like, if I want to focus on bigger arms, I probably still want to make sure I'm doing maybe like a close grip bench press or a dumbbell bench press or pull-ups or chin-ups or heavy rows, right? Those are all things that you can facilitate to good quality upper arm development, but also giving me quality chest and back and making that more time efficient rather than doing a bunch of close grip push-ups and tricep press downs and dips. Like, there's places for those, but we don't need to train like a bro to improve those places for most people. Smart big bang for your buck training is going to take care of a lot of that. And then you throw in some stuff at the tail end, or every couple days or every training session, you're doing one thing that you know they want to focus on. If it's arms, for example, one day we're doing trip press downs, another day we're doing close grip push-ups, another day we might do dumbbell skull crushers, right? Those are ways that you can say, okay, we're doing a lot of direct tricep work and they're going to feel that, and that's going to help them get more buy-in, even though that you know maybe the bench press and the rows and the overhead presses are the ones carrying majority of the progress that you're going to see, right? So it's ebb and flow. You got to give a little, you got to take a little. That's just a part of the art of coaching when it comes to working with clients and helping them not only get the training that they think they want, but you're also giving them the training that they need at the end of the day. All right. Myth number five is that cardio is going to kill your gains. And this is a bro science classic that you've probably all heard. And the myth in its strongest form usually goes something like this, that if you do any kind of aerobic conditioning while you're trying to build muscle, you're going to compromise your hypertrophy and your strength. And the body supposedly can't adapt in two directions at once, so cardio is the enemy of lifting at the end of the day. And here's what the research actually says. And I think this is interesting for most people to probably hear, that the phenomenon people are referencing is called the interference effect. And it was first proposed by Robert Hickinson in 1980, so, you know, a long time ago. And he found that combined endurance and strength training produced less strength gains than strength training alone over a 10-week protocol. Now, that finding has been refined and refined and refined since that study done in 1980, and we know a lot more now than we did way back then. Jacob Wilson and colleagues published a meta-analysis in 2012 in the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research that looked at 21 studies on concurrent training. And the conclusions were nuanced and important here. So one, the modality of cardiovascular exercise matters. It's very important. Running, with its eccentric loading and mechanical interference with lower body lifting, produced more interference than, say, cycling did. Cycling produced more interference than swimming. So if you have an athlete trying to build leg mass, having them run hill repeats is going to interfere more than having them, say, like ride a bike or do some cycling work. Number two is that the duration matters. Longer cardio sessions over 45 minutes produced more interference than shorter sessions. So short, intense intervals, 20 to 30 minutes, produced minimal interference and in some cases supported strength gains by improving recovery between sets. Number three is that the frequency matters. Three or more cardio sessions per week produced more interference than one to two training sessions. And number four, and to me, this is a big one, is that the timing matters. Separating cardio and lifting by at least 6 hours or putting them on different days dramatically reduced interference. So doing them back to back, especially cardio before you're lifting, was the worst case scenario. And so the actual translation here is that cardio is not killing your gains. That doing too much of the wrong type of cardio at the wrong time in the wrong proximity to your lifting and training can compromise your gains. And that's much more useful coaching insight than stop doing cardiovascular exercise. And so for most of our clients, here's what the evidence is supporting. That if you're training for hypertrophy, 2 to 3 sessions a week of moderate intensity cardiovascular exercise, 20 to 30 minutes of, say, cycling, incline walking, stair machine, stairmaster, is going to support recovery, improve work capacity, support cardiovascular health, and have negligible impact on muscle growth. In fact, it may actually help by improving nutrient delivery to the trained muscles between sessions. So if you're training for maximal strength in a sport like powerlifting, for example, you can still keep 2 cardiovascular sessions a week for cardiovascular and body weight management reasons. Just keep them short, keep them low impact, and don't do them on the same day as heavy lower body work. Now, for athletes whose sports demands aerobic capacity, like most field sports, combat sports, anything with sustained efforts, the conversation here is going to be a little different because they need the conditioning regardless. Okay, they have to be conditioned to be somewhat decent at their sport. So the job is to program it intelligently so it complements the strength work instead of undermining. And the other thing I want to address quickly here is the health side of this. The cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death in the developed world today. So aerobic capacity, also measured as your VO2 max, is one of the single strongest predictors of all-cause mortality. Now, research from Mandesker and colleagues in JAMA Network Open in 2018 found that the highest VO2 max quintile had a 60 to 70% lower mortality risk for over a decade compared to the lowest quintile. So 60 to 70%, that is not a small effect of difference, right? That is massive. So when we happen to tell clients or athletes or people to stop doing cardiovascular exercise because it's killing their gains or their progress, we might be saving them 3% of theoretical muscle growth, but we could be even worse, costing them upwards of 5 to 10 years of their life expectancy and getting more out of the quality of their life. And I think that trade-off is not good coaching. I think finding a middle ground is important for the majority of people. Cardiovascular work is something that I have picked up much more in my own training, making sure I'm doing usually 2 days per week. And I do feel that it's helped me feel more recovered between my sessions. I'm definitely doing more quality work. I find that I get out of breath less. I'm able to just push things. If I'm doing random stuff around the house or, going outside or doing things with my kid, right, I'm not nearly as tired and exhausted. I think that's incredibly important, especially if you want to factor this into just doing this with things in your normal daily life, right? You want to be able to do stuff, walk up a flight of stairs without being tired and winded. That's kind of a bad thing. And it's a bad trade-off to be able to try to squat X amount of weight. It's not worth it. Now, for me, the coaching takeaway is going to be this, is that the cardiovascular exercise is not the enemy. It never has been. It never should have been. That cardiovascular work, when programmed without intelligence, I think is the enemy. So build conditioning into athletes and clients' weeks deliberately where you can, match the modality to the sport, the goal, separate it from lifting when absolutely possible, and stop pretending that aerobic fitness is optional just because the bodybuilding subculture decided it was whenever they happened to decide that. All right, myth number 6 is that you have to eat protein every 2 to 3 hours or you will lose your muscle and gains. The anabolic window myth, right, and all of its various forms. So the popular version of this says that you have to consume protein every 2 to 3 hours or you're going to fall out of a quote-unquote anabolic state and you start catabolizing muscle. A related version says that you have a 30-minute post-workout window to slam a protein shake or you lose your gains for that training session. Both versions are wrong, okay? Both versions are very profitable for whoever's selling you protein bars, RTDs, protein shakes. Specific coaching, right? That's all a bunch of crap. So I want to address the timing question here first. Now, Brad Schoenfeld, Alan Aragon, and James Krieger published a 2013 meta-analysis in the Journal of International Society of Sports and Nutrition specifically examining the post-workout protein window. And the conclusion that they had was that controlling for total daily protein intake, the timing of post-workout protein had no significant independent effect on hypertrophy. Absolutely zero. The anabolic window in its strictest form doesn't even exist. So what matters is total daily protein and, to a lesser extent, distribution across the day. So for total intake, the gold standard reference is a 2018 meta-analysis from Robert Morton and colleagues in the British Journal of Sports Medicine. And they synthesized that 49 studies and found that protein intake above approximately 1.6 grams per kilogram of body weight per day produced no additional hypertrophy benefits in resistance trained adults. That's the ceiling for muscle building purposes. Above 1.6 grams per kilogram, and you're probably just having expensive protein at the end of the day. Now, if you love to eat meat, I think that's fine. But research tends to show that 1.6 grams per kilogram is really about the top end that you really kind of need to try to hit. Now, there are reasons to go higher than that 1.6 grams per kilogram. Eric Helms and colleagues in their 2014 review in the Journal of International Society of Sports Nutrition recommend up to 3.1 grams per kilogram of fat-free mass during caloric deficits, especially for very lean athletes, because higher protein helps preserve muscle when energy is restricted. So during, say, fat loss phases, going for higher does seem to make sense here. But for the average client just trying to build muscle in a maintenance or in a surplus, you know, being introduced to quality strength training and trying to improve their health, 1.6 to 2.2 grams per kilogram of body weight is the evidence-based range that most people are going to suggest. To make that very clear, that's about 0.8 to 1.0 grams per pound of body weight. So if you happen to be 175 pounds, about 175 grams, maybe even 150 grams is going to be enough to get things done. Now, for the distribution side, Arrieta and colleagues published a study in the 2013 Journal of Physiology comparing different protein distribution patterns. So they took 20 grams every 3 hours versus 10 grams every 90 minutes versus 40 grams every 6 hours, all matched for the total daily protein. The most evenly distributed pattern, so 20 grams every 3 hours, produced the highest rate of muscle protein synthesis over the day. So there is some marginal benefit to spreading protein out across the day, but every 3 hours is a long way from every 2 to 3 hours or that you're going to catabolize and never see any progress. Now, the actual coaching point here is that you should hit your daily total protein that you need to hit and get a reasonable dose at every meal that you're sitting down to have or that you're, you know, drinking along the way, whatever. So 25 to 40 grams, depending on your body size. And don't lose sleep if you happen to go 5 hours between meals. It's not going to be in the world. It's not like you're going to lose any muscle there. And I think here is the bigger picture, is that the fitness industry has manufactured a level of anxiety around protein timing that's completely disproportionate to the physiology. Now, the half-life of amino acids in circulation is hours, okay? It's not in minutes. So your body has substantial protein turnover from existing tissues, even in fasted states. So you're not going to lose meaningful muscle by missing a quote-unquote feeding. You have to be in a sustained energy deficit with low total protein intake with inadequate training stimulus for weeks before you'd see meaningful muscle loss. Now, the myth persists because it sells products, okay? I'm old enough that I remember everybody talking about taking, the Muscle Tech protein and everything else and having that, you know, the Weibullock and all that kind of stuff, right? That was very pushed heavily in the early 2000s, and it's because it sells product and makes people money. Now, if you can convince a lifter that they need to eat protein every 2 hours, they're going to end up buying more protein, especially probably protein powder from a convenience standpoint. So they're going to buy PD shakes to keep in their car or their gym bag or at the work refrigerator, right? They're going to buy more protein bars because they're stable. They last long. They're going to buy convenient powders that taste relatively good. The economic incentive to keep this myth alive is still happening in the fitness industry. Now, for our clients, for coaches and trainers here, here's the simple way to coach and help them. One, tell them to hit their total daily protein somewhere again between that 1.6 to 2.2 grams per kilogram of body weight, or, you know, aiming for that 0.8 or 1.0 per pound of body weight. Or you can even have them get up to that 2.4 to 3.0 grams per kilogram of fat-free mass if you're cutting or they're trying to lose a substantial amount of weight and they are very lean. Now, number two is going to be to distribute that protein that you need for the total amount of the day across 3 to 5 eating occasions or meals throughout the day, with each time that you're eating containing a reasonable protein dose. And then number three, don't panic about the absolute time. The pre-workout meal and the post-workout meal don't have to be within minutes of training. A meal in the 2 to 3 hours surrounding training is more than sufficient for you to get your progress, get the amino acid profile, and get all the benefits that you need. Then number four, this is more for the coaches, trainers, maybe even gym owners that are listening, that you should stop selling timing anxiety to your clients. It's not good quality nutrition advice, and it makes our industry look like a supplement company propaganda. Sell people the basics. Be honest with them. Just tell them, hey, this is not a protein you're going to get. Let's spread over the meals. We don't need to worry about the timing. Get all that down, because the majority of clients are having enough issues anyways with paralysis by analysis. So giving things a very basic framework of what they should do, 3 to 5 meals, 40 to 50 grams for most people is going to get it done at those levels, right? It's going to meet they need to meet. For most people, you're going to find that's the easiest way. If we get a serving of protein at every single meal, and it's even a serving or serving and a half, they're going to be good. So make the basics work for you. All right, myth number seven, is that static stretching before training prevents injuries? Now, this one is interesting because for 50 years, every PE teacher that we've had in every high school football coach or every kind of aerobics instructor over on TV commercials or whatever told us to stretch before we did physical activity. You know, hold this hamstring stretch for 30 seconds or this quad stretch for 30 seconds, the calves for 30 seconds, right? You're going to do the arm cross thing or whatever, touch your toes, count to 20. And the justification was always that it warmed up the muscles and it was going to prevent injuries. Now, the research has spent the last 20 years quietly demolishing this idea, and the most of the fitness world hasn't caught up yet. Now, David Bain and Anas Kouachi, I hope I pronounced that name correctly, published a comprehensive review in 2011 in the European Journal of Applied Physiology, looking at the effects of acute static stretching on performance injury, and the findings were striking. Number one was that static stretching of more than 60 seconds per muscle group performed immediately before exercise was consistently associated with a reduction in subsequent performance. So strength, power, sprint speed, and vertical jump all went down acutely after static stretching protocols of that duration. The effect sizes were small to moderate, but they were real and they were repeatable time after time again. Number two is that static stretching did not reduce the incidence of acute injuries and subsequent exercises. So the systematic reviews on this, including a Cochrane review from Herbert and colleagues, found insufficient evidence that pre-exercise static stretching meaningfully reduces injury risk in healthy populations. Number three, short duration static stretching, less than 30 seconds per muscle group, had minimal performance impact and minimal injury prevention effect, basically making it a wash. So the practice of holding long static stretching before training was, at the absolute best, neutral for injury prevention and at worst, actively hurting your performance from an athletic performance perspective. So what does work when it comes to having a quality warm-up? And that's going to be the dynamic warm-up. McMillan and colleagues published a study in 2006 in the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research comparing static stretching, dynamic warm-up, and no warm-up on power performance. The dynamic warm-up outperformed both alternatives. Movement-based warm-ups, so leg swings, hip circles, walking lunges, doing high knees, butt kicks, light skipping variations, these all elevate core temperature, increase muscle compliance through movement, prime the nervous system, and prepare the joints for the loading patterns of the training session. So the modern warm-up protocol for a strength athlete should look something like this, right? 5 to 7 minutes of light cardiovascular work, maybe on the bike, the rower, maybe if you want to jog, light incline walk. Then 5 to 10 minutes of dynamic movement, targeting the joints and tissues that you're about to load and use for that training session. And then specific warm-up sets of the day's main movement, progressively loading towards your working weight. So the total warm-up time, 15 to 20 minutes, no static holds, no static stretching. The minute you do walk on the bike or whatever, to then doing whatever kind of other general warm-up you're doing, 15 minutes seems to be a good sweet spot for most people. Now, static stretching does have a place, so it isn't just the pre-training side. Static stretching, post-training, or dedicated mobility sessions on off days can improve passive range of motion over time. So there's research from Mierdos and colleagues showing chronic static stretching protocols performed regularly over weeks does increase joint range of motion. If a client has tight hip flexors that limit their squat depth, prolonging static hip flexor stretches into their cool down or off day mobility work can certainly help, just not necessarily in the warm up aspect. Now, for coaches and trainers, this is one of the easiest myths to clean up in our practice and how we do things, is that we look at how our warm ups are built and structured. If they include long static holds at the front end of the training session, we want to replace those with more dynamic flow, specific movement preparation, more active movement-based things that are going to do very similar things. Your athletes will perform better not only in that immediate session, but they also won't be more injured and they'll spend more of that time actually being productive at the end of the day. You should be able to get in and out quicker rather than just kind of sitting there hanging out. And for me, the bigger takeaway here again is really more about how slowly the fitness industry updates its practices in response to the research that we have. And so the static stretching warm-up findings have been clear since the early 2000s. We're now obviously over 20 years past those findings, and you can still walk into gyms all over America or wherever you happen to be living and see athletes holding 30-second hamstring stretches before they go to squat or deadlift or do different lower body activities. And that gap between what the research says and what the industry does is the gap this show exists to close at the end of the day, which is what I'm trying to obviously break through here, doing this one myth at a time for this particular episode. All right, moving on to the last one. Myth number 8 is that you need supplements to make real progress. And I want to close with this one because I think it touches every other myth that we've kind of talked about here today. And the myth that you need a stack of supplements to make more progress in the gym, so things like pre-workout, BCAAs, EAAs, mass gainers, testosterone boosters, joint support, greens powders, adaptogen, nootropics, the list is endless and the marketing is relentless from these guys. So here's what the research actually is supporting for healthier adult lifter looking to make progress, improve their health. Number one is going to be creatine monohydrate. They have 3 to 5 grams per day, probably the most well-studied performance supplement in human history. It works, it's cheap, it's safe, and the magnitude effect on strength and lean muscle mass is modest, but it's real. Kreider and colleagues published a comprehensive review in 2017 in the Journal of International Society of Sports Nutrition, synthesizing the literature, and the conclusion was that creatine improves anaerobic performance, supports muscle hypertrophy, and may have cognitive and neuroprotective benefits as well. So if you can, you should be taking creatine. Now, the next one is going to be caffeine, and if it's used strategically. So 100 to 400 milligrams pre-training, dose dependent on body weight and tolerance, of course. It's going to improve your perceived exertion, reaction time, and high-intensity performance. So Grigic and colleagues in 2020 in the British Journal of Sports Medicine reviewed the effects on resistance training performance and found modest but consistent improvements of those that took caffeine. So it's useful, not essential. You know, if you're dragging butt, I do think it's a way to kind of get going. You got a big squat day or a big bench day, need some extra performance boost, I do think caffeine has its place, but you obviously do not want to abuse it in any way, shape, or form. Next is going to be vitamin D, especially if you're deficient. So most of the Western world is, especially in the winter months. So if you really want to know, you should go get your blood work done and go from there. So if your serum 25 hydroxy vitamin D is below 30 nanograms per milliliter, I believe that you should supplement. Doses of 1,000 to 2,000 IU per day are sufficient for most people. I personally should take 5,000 IU per day. You know, adjust this based upon your needs and how much you get outside. The more you get outside, the more sunlight you get, the less you're going to need. But at the end of the day, go get a blood work test done, and then you'll know exactly where you're at, and then talk with your medical providers from there. I also want to make sure that you're taking vitamin D3. Okay, don't buy the D2, buy the D3. And if you can also get that paired with vitamin K, you're also going to see better absorption there as well. Next one is going to be whey or any other kind of high quality protein powder. only as a convenience tool to help you hit your daily protein intake. It's not magical. It's just usual. It's convenient. I usually have a protein shake every morning on the way into work. It's just convenient and lets me get a little more sleep. And I usually do not like to have heavy food sit on my stomach. You know, I get up early. Having that with a handful of nuts on the way to the gym is a great way for me to get healthy fats, good quality protein. It gets a lot of water in my system relatively quick. So I'm, you know, sleeping all night is going to reduce your ability of being dehydrated. There's lots of benefits there. For me, that's just what works well. But you can obviously figure that out if it works well for you and just keep it around just to help make sure that your protein intake. Or if you happen to be somebody that really struggles to put down a lot of food in one go, it's a good way to supplement on top of your food if you're trying to gain a lot of weight as well and still make sure you're getting enough protein. For me, that's the list. That's the main stuff I think is important. Creatine, caffeine when you need it, vitamin D is needed based off on your blood work, and then a protein powder from a convenience standpoint. For 95% of clients and athletes, the supplement strategy stops there. I think that's really where you need to recommend stuff and you adjust per person from there. But those are kind of like the four things that majority of people are going to see benefits from probably immediately and help them continue to make progress. Everything else, from pre-workouts with the proprietary blends, BCAAs, mass gainers, your test boosters, your fat burners, your performance quote-unquote stacks, either the active ingredients are present in negligible doses or the active ingredients don't have a meaningful evidence behind them, or the cost-benefit ratio is so poor that it's bad financial advice to recommend them. And let me address one specifically because it does come up constantly, especially with parents for me, is branched-chain amino acids or BCAAs. The pitch is that you take them around to boost around your training to boost your muscle protein synthesis and reduce muscle breakdown. The reality is that if you're consuming adequate total daily protein, your body is already going to have enough of the BCAAs it needs. And Robert Wolf published an analysis in 2017 in the Journal of International Society of Sports Nutrition showing that BCAAs alone cannot maximally stimulate muscle protein synthesis because the other essential amino acids become rate limiting. So BCAA supplementation on a backdrop of adequate dietary protein is essentially worthless. So you're paying premium prices of amino acids that you already have, your chicken, your eggs, your beef, and wherever else you're getting your protein sources from. Now, here's where I want to be honest about something. Is there's a reason supplements get pushed so hard. It's not because they work. It's because the margins are spectacular. A bottle of pre-workout that costs $4 to manufacture sells for $50. And a bottle of BCAAs that costs less than that and sells for $40. My personal trainers and influencers get affiliate kickbacks for pushing these products. And sponsorship contracts depend on athletes claiming to use them or to push them X amounts or so many weeks or whatever. Now, the economic structure of the supplement industry guarantees that you know, as a coach or even as a consumer, are going to be bombarded with claims that aren't supported by the research. Now, the counter move here is going to be education, telling your clients or your friends, colleagues, what actually works, okay? Creatine, caffeine, adequate protein, vitamin D if the blood work indicates they need it. Save them money, build their trust. They'll refer their friends, but you're also having to have more money spent on things they actually need, like quality food, quality training, things like that. And then the broader lesson here is that we're going to bring this back that I did to the start of the episode, that the fitness industry sells complexity because complexity is profitable. The fitness industry loves to make profit off of not only new clients and people new into fitness, but also people that make new fitness for a living like myself. So the truth is the inputs that drive 80 to 90% of our clients' progress and results are unsexy and they're old news, right? Progressive resistance training, adequate protein, sufficient sleep, total weekly volume, consistent caloric balance. That is the program and the nuts and bolts of making progress long-term for your health and fitness. Everything else is right around like a little bit of errors and extra noise and things that really are not going to do what we need them to do, right? The coaches and trainers who succeed long-term in this industry are the ones who stop selling the noise and the confrontational stuff and start anchoring everything and what actually works, big on the basics, getting their clients to take those big steps or the big things that are going to do what they need them to do and make progress from there. And then you sprinkle in some of the small stuff if people happen to be interested in it. But if you kick over the big rocks, you're going to get people results a lot faster. You're probably going to save them money. That gets a lot of buy-in there as well. So there you have it. There's 8 different things and myths. We could definitely do this episode probably 3 more times and still not run out of myths for me to, you know, bury and break down. But those 8 will move the needle for 90% of people, maybe even more of people listening and or trying to improve their health, fitness, and lifestyle. And so I want to leave you with this, is that the fitness industry, at the end of the day, it has a credibility problem. Now, I work in the fitness industry, and it sucks to admit that, but it's just the truth. And at the end of the day, we have earned it, right? We have decades of recycled bro science. We've got supplement company nonsense. We've got certification programs that teach outdated material. And we have influencer marketing dressed up as expertise that have made it harder than ever for an honest coach or trainer to be trusted by a skeptical client. So the way out of that is doing this one coach, one trainer, or one listener in my case here at a time, one programming decision at a time, one conversation with a client at a time, where we choose the research over the cliche or the fancy, sexy marketing. That's the work. That's ultimately what my show and all the information that I produce and education and content that I produce is all about. Okay, it's trying to get one person better and providing one valuable piece of education that can take you to the next level and help you out. So if this episode hit home with you, do me a favor, share it with a coach, trainer, friend in your network who needs to hear it, or maybe somebody that doesn't believe in these myths and you want to provide it to them. I got the information here for you. Be happy for you to share that with them. You know, the conversations that I try to hold in these episodes are the ones I'm trying to move the industry forward, especially having some of the uncomfortable ones, but also educating the average person and client as well. Now, if you happen to want more things and more education like this, do me a favor. You can subscribe over on YouTube if you happen to not be watching there. If you're listening on Spotify, Apple, iTunes, whatever, go over to YouTube, hit that subscribe button for me, even like the video. You can also follow the show over on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can also do me a favor, leave a 5-star review there as well. I think you can even leave comments now over on Spotify. So Spotify's kind of up in their game. All that I would really appreciate. And you can also come find me over on Instagram at bsmitley. That's bsmitley. I post more of these breakdowns, shorter form stuff there. I post lots of content there. You can also shoot me a DM. I'd be more than happy to answer that. And as always, if you do need supplements, you need some protein, some vitamin D, some caffeine, things like that, I trust nobody else but NutriBio. So you can go check them out. Go to NutriBio.com. And if you enter code SMITLEY10, that's SMITLEY10, you'll get 10% off every single order that you have whenever you use that code. Just for the listeners, clients, people that I happen to love and appreciate, get that. I do not post that publicly on social media. So if you haven't been listening to this part of the episode and you like NutriBio, make sure you pop over there, check them out. And that'd be a good place for you to get some of that vitamin D3 and K2. Personally, where I get it from, and I take it every single day. Now, for coaches, trainers, gym owners, you know, we know that we're better than the version of the industry that is currently out there and that we've been handed. So I really hope that you can help me improve it one listen at a time, one share at a time, and continue to make good quality progress. And if you happen to not be a trainer, you just happen to listen to this and educating yourself overall in the fitness industry, again, I appreciate you being here. Hopefully you took one awesome thing away. If you could share it with somebody else you like, that also helps me out as well. I'm your host, Brandon Smitley. Thanks for tuning in for Thrift Smart Podcast, and I'll see you at the next episode.
Thanks for listening to Thrift Smart Podcast. Make sure you give us a follow on Spotify, iTunes, or anywhere else you like to consume your podcast. You can also check us out on YouTube at The Smitley, where you'll find clips and lots of educational-based material for strength and conditioning and exercise science. You can also make sure you give me a follow on Instagram at bsmitley or at Team Thirst, which is my gym Instagram page. For any more future updates on episodes to come, you can make sure you follow me there. I'm your host, Brandon Smitley. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you at the next episode.